Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Jonathan Lethem first reeled me in with his novel As She Climbed Across the Table. I was completely captured by his creativity and voice. In its review of Motherless Brooklyn, the New York Times Book Review said, "The novel immerses us in the mind's dense thicket, a place where words split and twine in an ever-deepening tangle." I feel that way about each of Mr. Lethem's books, and I wish I had said that. When the advanced reader's copy of Chronic City landed on my desk, one of the definite perks of being a bookseller for as many years as I have been, I got to read it months ago, I couldn't wait to immerse myself in the novel, and I wasn't disappointed. Please join me in welcoming Jonathan Lethem.
Thank you. Thank you, Heather. That was a nice introduction. Thanks, everyone, for coming out. I guess the snow isn't that impressive to you guys, but... So I'm going to start reading to you from the very beginning of this book, which means I don't need to say a whole lot, but I'll say a couple of things. The city of New York in Chronic City is both the real Manhattan of the present day and a sort of off-kilter, surreal version of itself. And that means that there are lots of very ordinary lives being lived there, but there are also things going on like a giant escaped tiger that's wrecking parts of the Upper East Side. And the main character of the book, or the two main characters, are the narrator, Chase, and a new friend of Chase's named Perkis. And the first chapter describes their meeting. And the only one of the really strange things going on in the background that comes into this first bit is that Chase, who's kind of a retired child star, he's no longer acting in anything. He kind of coasts on his reputation and former fame, and makes his living off the residuals from the TV show. Chase has unexpectedly fallen into a new kind of notoriety in New York City because he's got a girlfriend, a fiance actually, who's an astronaut, and she was on a routine mission of, you know, an American mission to visit the Soviet space station. And then, you know, so she was up there with a bunch of cosmonauts, and then there was a kind of space catastrophe that trapped her there. And so she and the Russians are stuck in orbit, and this is a kind of soap opera that's going on in the backdrop of everyone's lives, and it means that Chase is now seen as a kind of tragic figure. Which is something he finds very confusing, a role he's not comfortable with at all. But that's, as I say, just in the background. This is really the story of making a very, very weird new friend. I first met Perkis Tooth in an office, not an office where he worked, though I was confused about this at the time. This was in the headquarters of the Criterion Collection, at 52nd Street and 3rd Avenue, on a weekday afternoon at the end of summer. I'd gone there to record a series of voiceovers for one of Criterion's high-end DVD reissues, a 1950s film noir called The City is a Maze. My role was to play the voice of that film's director. I would read a series of statements culled from his interviews and articles as part of a supplemental documentary being prepared by the curatorial geniuses at Criterion, a couple of whom I'd met at a dinner party. In drawing me into the project, they'd supplied me with a batch of research materials, which I'd browsed unsystematically, as well as a working version of their reconstruction of the film, in order for me to glean what the excitement was all about. It was the first I'd heard of this film, so this was hardly a labor of passion. But the enthusiasm of film buffs is infectious, and I liked the movie. I no longer considered myself a working actor. This was the only sort of stuff I did anymore, riding the exhaust of my former and vanishing celebrity, the smoky half-life of a former child star. As it was an eccentric favor, really. I was curious to see the inside of Criterion's operation. This was the first week of September. My city's back-to-school mood always inspired me to find something to do with my idle hands. In those days, with Janice far away, Janice is the name of the astronaut, I lived too much on the surface of things, parties, gossip, assignations, in which I was the go-between or vicarious friend. Workplaces fascinated me, the zones where Manhattan's veneer gave way to the practical world. I recorded the director's words in a sound chamber in the technical wing of Criterion's crowded, ramshackle offices. In the room outside the chamber, where the sound man sat giving me cues through a headset, a restorer also sat, peering at a screen and guiding a cursor with a mouse, diligently erasing celluloid scratches and blots, frame by digital frame, from the bare bodies of hippies cavorting in a mud puddle. I was told he was restoring I Am Curious Yellow. Afterwards, I was retrieved by the producer who'd enlisted me for the project, Susan Eldred. It had been Susan and her colleague I'd met at the dinner party, unguarded, embracing people with a passion for a world of cinematic minutiae, and for whom I'd felt an instantaneous affection. Susan led me to her office, a cavern with one paltry window and shelves stacked with VHS tapes, more lost films petitioning for Criterion's rescue. Susan shared her office, it appeared. Not with the colleague I'd met at the party, but another person. He sat beneath the straining shelves, notebook in hand, gaze distant. It seemed too small an office to share. No sooner did Susan introduce me to Perkistooth and give me an invoice to sign than she was called away for some consultation elsewhere. Perkis was, that first time, lapsed into what I would soon learn to call one of his ellipsistic moods. Perkistooth himself later supplied that descriptive word, ellipsistic, derived from ellipsis, a species of blank interval, a nod or fugue in which he was neither depressed nor undepressed, not struggling to finish a thought nor to begin one, merely between, pause button pushed. I certainly stared at him. With Tooth's turtle posture and the utter slackness of his being, his receding hairline and antique manner of dress, trim-tapered suit, ferociously wrinkled silk with the shine worn off, moldering tennis shoes, I could have taken him for elderly. When he stirred, his hand brushing the open notebook page as if taking dictation with an invisible pen, and I read his pale, adolescent features, I guessed he was in his 50s, still a decade wrong, though Perkistooth had been out of the sunlight for a while. He was in his early 40s, barely older than me. I'd mistaken him for old because I'd taken him for important. He now looked up and I saw one undisciplined hazel eye wander under its calf lid toward his nose. That eye wanted to cross, to discredit Perkistooth's whole sober aura with a comic jape. His other eye ignored the gambit, trained on me. "You're the actor," he said. "Yes," I said. "So," he said, "I'm doing the liner notes. For City is a Maze, I mean." "Oh, good," I said. "I do a lot of them," he told me. "Prelude to a Certain Midnight, Recalcitrant Women, The Unholy City, Echolalia." "All film noir?" I asked. "Oh, gosh, no," he said. "You've never seen Werner Herzog's Echolalia?" "No." "Well, I wrote the liner notes," he said, "but it isn't exactly released yet. I'm still trying to convince Eldred." Perkistooth, I would soon learn, called everyone by their last name, as though famous or arrested. His mind's landscape was epic, dotted with towering figures like Easter Island heads. At that moment, Eldred, Susan, returned to her office. "So," he said to her, "have you got that tape of Echolalia around here somewhere?" He cast his eyes, the good left and the wandering right, at her shelves, at the cacophony of titles scribbled on labels there. "I want him to see it," he said. Susan raised her eyebrows and he shrank. "I don't know where it is," she said. Never mind, said Perkis. Have you been harassing my guest, Perkis? Said Susan. What do you mean? He said. Susan Eldred turned to me and collected the signed release. Then we made our farewell. Then, as I got to the elevator, Perkis Tooth hurried through the sliding doors to join me, crushing his antique felt hat onto his crown as he did. The elevator, like so many others behind Midtown edifices, was tiny and rattletrap, little more than a glorified dumbwaiter. There was no margin for pretending we hadn't just been in that office together. Bad eye migrating slightly, Perkis Tooth gave me a lunar look, neither unfriendly nor apologetic. Despite his vintage costume, he wasn't some dapper retro-fetishist. His shirt collar was grubby and crumpled. The green-gray sneakers, like mummified sponges, glimpsed within a janitor's bucket. "So," he said again. "So, I'll lend you my own copy of Echolalia, even though I never lend anything, because I think you ought to see it." "Sure," I said. "It's a sort of essay film," he explained. "Werner Herzog shot it on the set of Morrison Groom's Nowhere Near. Groom's movie was never finished, you know. Echolalia documents Herzog's attempts to interview Marlon Brando on the set. Brando doesn't want to give the interview, and whenever Herzog corners him, Brando just parrots whatever Herzog's said back to him. You know, Echolalia." "Yes," I said, flummoxed, as I would so often later find myself, by Tooth's torrential specifics. "But," he continued, "it's also the only way you can see any of Nowhere Near. Morrison Groom destroyed the footage, so the scenes reproduced in Echolalia are, ironically, all that remains of that film." "It sounds incredible," I said. "Of course, you know Morrison Groom's suicide was probably faked." My nod was a lie. The doors opened and we stumbled together out to the pavement, tangling at every threshold. "You first. Oops, after you. Sorry." We faced each other, mid-Wednesday Manhattan throngs islanding us in their stream. Perkis grew formally clipped, perhaps belatedly eager to show he wasn't harassing me. "So," he said, "I'm off." "Very good to see you." "So," he ground to a halt, expectant. "Yes," I said. "If you want to come by for the tape." I felt as though I were failing some test. I wasn't sure. Perkis Tooth dealt in occult knowledge and measured with secret calipers. I'd never know when I'd crossed some invisible frontier, visible to Perkis in the air between us. "Do you want to give me your card?" I said. He scowled. "Eldred knows where to find me." His pride intervened and he was gone. For a phone call so life-altering as mine to Susan Eldred, I ought to have had some fine reason. Yet here I was, dialing Criterion's receptionist later that afternoon, asking first for Perkis Tooth and then, when she claimed no familiarity with that name, for Susan Eldred, spurred by nothing better than a cocktail of two parts whim and one part guilt. Manhattan's volunteer, that's me, I may as well admit it. Was I curious about Echolalia? Or Morrison Groom's faked suicide? Or Perkis Tooth's lulls and intensities? Or the slippage in his right eye's gaze? Well, all of it and none of it. That's the only answer. Perhaps I already adored Perkis Tooth and already sensed that it was his friendship I required to usher me into the strange next phase of my being, to unmoor me from the curious eddy into which I'd drifted. How very soon after our first encounter I'd come to adore and to need Perkis makes it awfully hard to know to what extent such feelings were inexplicably already underway. "Your office mate," I said to Susan now. "They didn't recognize his name at the front desk. Maybe I heard it wrong." "Perkis?" Susan laughed. "He doesn't work here." "He said he wrote your liner notes." "Yes, he's written a couple, sure, but he doesn't work here. He just comes up and occupies space sometimes. I'm sort of Perkis's babysitter. I don't even always notice him anymore. You saw how he can be. I hope he wasn't bothering you." "No. No," I said. I was hoping to get in touch with him, actually." Susan Eldred gave me Perkis Tooth's number, then paused. "I guess you must have recognized his name," she said. "No." "Well," she said, "in fact, he's really quite an amazing critic. When I was at NYU, all my friends and I used to idolize him. When I first got the chance to hire him to do a liner note, I was quite in awe. It was shocking how young he was. It seemed like I'd grown up reading his stuff and seeing his posters. "Posters?" I asked. "Yes," said Susan. "He used to do this thing where he'd write these rants on posters and put them up all around Manhattan. These sort of brilliant critiques of things. Current events, media rumors, public art. They were a kind of public art, I guess. Everyone thought it was very mysterious and important. Then he got hired by Rolling Stone. They gave him this big column. He was sort of, I don't know, Hunter Thompson meets Pauline Kael for about 5 minutes. If that makes any sense." "Sure," I said. "Anyway," Susan continued, "the point is, he sort of used up a lot of people's patience with certain kinds of paranoid stuff. I didn't really get it until I started working with him myself. I mean, I like Perkis a lot. I just don't want you to feel that I wasted your time or got you enmeshed in any schemes." People could be absurdly protective, as if a retired actor's hours were so precious. This was, I assumed, second-hand affect, a leakage from Janice's otherworldly agenda. I was famously in love with a woman who had no time to spare, not even a breath. Her every breath, in fact, measured out of tanks of recycled air. If an astronaut made room for me on her schedule, my own prerogatives must be as crucial as an astronaut's. The opposite was true. "Thank you," I said now. "I'll be sure not to get enmeshed." Perkis Tooth was my neighbor, it turned out. His apartment was on East 84th Street, 6 blocks from mine, in one of those anonymous warrens tucked behind innocuous storefronts, buildings without lobbies, let alone doormen. The shop downstairs, Brandy's Piano Bar, was a corny-looking night spot I could have passed 1,000 times without once noticing. To live in Manhattan is to be persistently amazed at the worlds squirreled inside one another, the chaotic intricacy with which realms interleave. Like those lines of television cable and fresh water and steam heat and outgoing sewage and telephone wire and whatever else, which cohabit in the same intestinal holes that pavement-demolishing workmen periodically wrench open to the daylight and to our passing, disturbed glances. We only pretend to live on something orderly as a grid. Waiting for Perkis Tooth's door buzzer to sound and finding my way inside, I felt my interior map expand to allow for the reality of this place. The corridor floor's lumpy checkerboard mosaic, the cloying citrus of the superintendent's disinfectant oil, the bank of dented brass mailboxes, and the keening of a dog from behind an upstairs door, alerted to the buzzer and my scuffling boot heels. I have trouble believing anything exists until I know it bodily. Perkis Tooth lived in 1R, a half level up, the building's rear. He widened his door just enough for me to slip inside, directly to what revealed itself to be his kitchen. Perkis, though barefoot, wore another antique-looking suit, green corduroy this time, the only formal thing my entry revealed. The place was a bohemian grotto. The kitchen a kitchen only in the sense of having a sink and stove built in. Books filled the open cabinet spaces above the sink. The countertop was occupied with a CD player and hundreds of discs, in and out of jewel cases, many hand-labeled with a permanent marker. A hot water pipe whined. Beyond, the other rooms of the apartment were dim at midday, the windows draped. Then there were the broadsides, the ones Susan Eldred had described. Unframed, thumbtacked to every wall, bare of bookshelves, in the kitchen and in the darkened rooms, were Perkis Tooth's famous posters. Their paper yellowing, the lettering veering between a stylish cartoonist's or graffitiist's handmade font and the obsessive scrawl of an outsider artist. I recognized them, remembered them. They'd been ubiquitous downtown a decade before, on construction site boards, over subway advertisements. Element in the graphic cacophony of the city, one gleans helplessly at the edges of vision. Perkis retreated to give me clearance to shut the door. Stranded in the room center in his suit and bare feet, palms defensively wide as if expecting something unsavory to be tossed his way, he reminded me of a Edvard Munch painting I'd once seen, a self-portrait showing the painter wide-eyed and whiskered, shrunken within his clothes. Which is to say, again, Perkis Tooth seemed older than his age. "I'll get you the videotape," he said, as if I'd challenged him. "Great," I said. "Let me find it. You sit down." He pulled out a chair at his small linoleum-topped table, like one you'd see at a diner. The chair matched the table. A dinette set, a collector's item. Perkis Tooth was nothing if not a collector. "Here," he said. He took a perfect finished joint from where it waited in the lip of an ashtray, clamped it in his mouth, and ignited the tip, then handed it to me unquestioningly. "It takes one to know one, I suppose." I drew on it while he went into the other room. When he returned, with a VHS cassette and his sneakers and a balled-up pair of white socks, he accepted the joint from me and smoked an inch of it, himself, intently. "So," he said, "do you want to get something to eat? I haven't been out all day." He laced his high tops. "Sure," I said. Out for Perkis Tooth wasn't usually far. He liked to feed at a glossy hamburger palace around the corner on 2nd Avenue called Jackson Hole, a den of gleaming chrome and newer, faker versions of the linoleum table in his kitchen. At 4 in the afternoon, we were pretty well alone there, the jukebox blaring hits to cover our bemused, befogged talk. It had been a while since I'd smoked pot. Everything was dawning strange. Signals received through an atmosphere eddied with hesitations, the whole universe drifting untethered like Perkis Tooth's vagrant eyeball. The waitress seemed to know Perkis, but he didn't greet her or touch his menu. He asked for a cheeseburger deluxe and a Coca-Cola. Helpless, I dittoed his order. Perkis seemed to dwell in this place as he had at the Criterion offices, indifferently, obliquely, as if he'd been born there yet still hadn't completely taken notice of the place. In the middle of our meal, Perkis halted some rant about Werner Herzog or Marlon Brando or Morrison Groom to announce what he'd made of me so far. "So, you've gotten to this point by being cute, haven't you, Chase?" His spidery fingers, elbow propped on the linoleum, kept the oozing, gory Jackson Hole burger aloft to mask his expression. One eye fixed me while the other crawled, now seeming a scalpel in operation on my own face. "You haven't changed," he said. "You're still like a dreamy child. That's the secret of your appeal. But they love you. They watch you like you're still on television." "Who?" I asked. "The rich people," he said. "The Manhattanites. You know who I mean." "Yes," I said. "You're supposed to be the saddest man in Manhattan," he said, "because of the astronaut who can't come home." So, no surprise, Perkis was another one who knew me as Janice Trumbull's fiancé. My heart's distress was daily newspaper fodder. Yes, I loved Janice Trumbull, the American trapped in orbit with the Russians, the astronaut who couldn't come home. This, beyond my childhood TV stardom, was what anyone knew about me, though some, like Susan Eldred, were too polite to mention it. "That's what everyone adores about you," he said. "I guess so. But I know your secret." I was startled. Did I have a secret? If I did, it was one of the things I'd misplaced in the last few years. I couldn't remember how I'd gotten from here to there, made the decisions that led from my child stardom to harmlessly dissipated Manhattan celebrity, nor how it was that I deserved the brave astronaut's love. I had trouble clearly recalling Janice. That was part of my sorrow. The day she launched for the space station, I must have undertaken to quit thinking of her, even while promising to keep a vigil here on Earth. I never dared tell anyone this fact. So if I had a secret, it was that I had conspired to forget my secret. Perkis eyed me slyly. Perhaps it was this policy to make this announcement that he knew their secret to any new acquaintance, just to see what they'd blurt out. "Keep your eyes and ears open," he told me now. "You're in a position to learn things." What things? Before I could ask, we were off again. Perkis's spiel encompassed Monty Hellman, Greil Marcus's lipstick traces, the mafia's blackmailing of J. Edgar Hoover over erotic secrets, Chet Baker, nothingism, the ruination Giuliani's administration had brought to the sacred squalor of Times Square, the genius of The Nuppet Show, Frederick Exley, corruption of the arts by commerce generally, Slavoj Žižek on Hitchcock, Norman Mailer on Muhammad Ali, Norman Mailer on graffiti and the space program, Brando as dissident icon, Brando as sexual saint, Brando as Napoleon in exile. Names I knew and others I didn't. Others I'd heard once and never troubled to wonder about. Mailer again and again, and Brando even more often. Perkis Tooth's primary idols seemed to be this robust and treacherous pair, Brando and Mailer, which only made Perkis seem frailer and more harmless by contrast. Maybe he ate Jackson Hole burgers in an attempt to burgeon himself, seeking girth in hopes of attracting the attention of Norman and Marlon, his chosen peers. He had the afternoon waitress refill his gallon-sized Coke, too. Then as our afternoon talk turned to evening, washed it all down with a black coffee. In our talk, marijuana confusion now gave way to caffeinated jags, like a cloud bank penetrated by buzzing airplanes. Did I read the New Yorker? This question had a dangerous urgency. It wasn't any one writer or article he was worried about, but the font. The meaning embedded at a preconscious level by the look of the magazine, the seal, as he described it, that the typography and layout put on dialectical thought. According to Perkis, to read the New Yorker was to find that you always already agreed, not with the New Yorker, but much more dismayingly with yourself. I tried hard to understand. Apparently, here was the paranoia Susan Eldred had warned me of. The New Yorker's font was controlling Perkistooth's mind. To defend himself, he frequently retyped their articles and printed them out in simple courier, an attempt to dissolve the magazine's oppressive context. Once, I'd enter his apartment to find him on his carpet with a pair of scissors, furiously slicing up and rearranging an issue of the magazine, trying to shatter its spell on his brain. But I'm confused in this account, surely. Can we have discussed so much the very first time? Well, the New Yorker, at least. Giuliani's auctioning of 42nd Street to Disney, yes. Mailer on NASA. J. Edgar Hoover in the Mafia's thrall. In the midst of these variations, the theme was always ingeniously and excitingly retrieved. In short, some human freedom had been leveraged from view at the level of consciousness itself. Liberty had been narrowed, winnowed, amnesiaced. Perkistooth used this new word without explaining. By it, he meant something like the Mafia itself would do, a whack, a rub out. Everything that mattered most was a victim in this perceptual murder plot. Further, always to blame was everyone. When rounding up the suspects, begin with yourself. Complicity, including his own, was Perkistooth's only doubtless conviction. The worst thing was to be sure you knew what you knew. The mistake the New Yorker's font induced. The horizon of everyday life was a mass daydream. Below it lay everything that mattered. By now we'd paid for our burgers and returned to his apartment. At his dinette table we sat and he strained some pot for seeds, then rolled another joint. The dope came out of a little plastic box marked with a laser-printed label reading Chronic in rainbow colors, a kind of brand name. We smoked the new joint relentlessly to a nub and went on talking. Perkis now free to gesticulate as he hadn't at Jackson Hole, yet he never grew florid, never in all his ferment, hyperventilated, or like some epileptic, bit his tongue. The feverish words were delivered with merciless cool. Perkis rifled through his CDs to find a record he wished to play me. The song was an angry and incoherent blues. Then, as if riled by the music, he turned and said, almost savagely, "So, I'm not a rock critic, you know." Okay. This was a point I found it easy enough to grant. People will say I am, because I wrote for Rolling Stone, but I hardly ever write about music. In fact, the broadsides hung in his rooms seemed to be full of references to pop songs, but I hesitated to point out the contradiction. He seemed to read my mind. Even when I do, I don't use that language. Oh, I said. Those people, the rock critics, I mean, do you want to know what they really are? Oh, sure. What are they? Super high-functioning autistics. Oh, I don't mean they're diagnosed or anything, but I diagnose them that way. They've got Asperger's syndrome. I mean, in the same sense that David Byrne or Al Gore has it. They're brilliant, but they're social misfits. How do you know? I said. As far as I knew, I'd never met anyone with Asperger's syndrome, or, for that matter, a rock critic, although I had once seen David Byrne at a party. Yet I'd heard enough already to find it odd hearing Perkistooth denouncing misfits. It's the way they talk, he said. He leaned in close to me and demonstrated his point. They aspirate their vowels nearer to the fronts of their mouths. Wow, I said. Yes, and when you see them talking in groups, they do it even more. It's self-reinforcing. Rock critics gather for purposes of mutual consolation, though they'd never call it that. They believe they're experts. Perkis, whether he knew it or not, continued to aspirate his vowels at the front of his mouth as he made his case. They can't see the forest for the trees. Self-reinforcing experts, I said, trying it on for size. Can't see the forest for the trees. I am, by deepest instinct, a mimic. Anyway, a VHS tape labeled Echolalia lay on the table between us. That's right, said Perkis seriously. Some of them even whistle when they speak. Whistle? I said. Exactly. Well, then thank God we're not rock critics, I said. You can say that again. He tongued the gum on another joint he'd been assembling, then inspected it for smoke worthiness, running it under his funny eye as if scanning a barcode. Satisfied, he ignited it. So, he said, I'm self-medicating. I smoke grass because of the headaches. Oh, migraine headaches, I said. Cluster headaches, he said. It's a variant of migraine. One side of the head. With two fingers, he tapped his skull. Of course, it was his right side, the headaches gravitating toward the deviant eye. They're called cluster headaches because they come in runs every day for a week or two at exactly the same time. Like a clock, like a rooster crowing. That's crazy, I said. I know, he said. Also, there's this visual effect, a blind spot on one side. Again, it was his right hand that waved. Like a blot in the center of my visual field. I thought of a riddle. What do you get when you cross a blind spot with a wandering eye? But we'd never once mentioned his eye, so I held back. The pot helps? I asked instead. The thing about a migraine-type experience, said Perkis, is that it's like being only half alive. You find yourself walking through this tomb world. Everything gets far away and kind of dull and dead. Smoking pulls me back into the world. It restores my appetites for food and sex and conversation. Well, I had evidence of food and conversation. Perkis Tooth's appetites and sex were to remain mysterious to me for the time being. This was still the first of the innumerable afternoons and evenings I surrendered to Perkis's kitchen table, to his smoldering ashtray and pot of scorched coffee, to his ancient CD boombox, which audibly whined as it spun in the silent gap between tracks, to our booth around the corner at Jackson Hole when a fierce craving for burgers and cola came over us, as it often did. Soon enough, those days all blurred happily together, for in the disconsolate year of Janice's broken orbit, Perkis Tooth was probably my best friend. I did watch Echolalia. The way Brando tormented his would-be interviewer was funny, but the profundity of the whole thing was lost on me. I suppose I was unfamiliar with the required context. When I returned it, I said so, and Perkis frowned. "Have you seen The Nascent?" he asked. No. Have you seen Anything That Hides? Not that one either. Have you seen any of Morrison Groom's films, Chase? Not knowingly, I said. How do you survive, he said, not unkindly. How do you even get along in the world, not understanding what goes on around you? That's what I have you for, I told him. You're my brain. Ah, he said in a Bogart voice. With your looks and my brain, we could go far. Exactly, I said. Something lit up inside him then, and he climbed on his chair in his bare feet and performed a small monkey-like dance, singing impromptu, If I'm your brain, you're in a whole lot of trouble. You picked the wrong brain. Perkis had a kind of beauty in his tiny, wiry body and his almost feral axe-blade skull with its gracefully tapered widow's peak and delicate features. Your brain's on drugs. Your brain's on fire, he said. Despite this lunatic warning, Perkis took charge of what he considered my education, loading me up with tapes and DVDs, sitting me down for essential viewings. Perkis's apartment was a place for consuming archival wonders, whether at his kitchen table or in the sagging chairs before his flat-screen television, bootlegged unreleased recordings by those in his pantheon, like Chet Baker, Nina Simone, or Neil Young, and grainy tapes of scarce film noir taped off late-night television broadcasts. Among these treasures was a videotape of a 90-minute episode of the detective show Columbo from 1981, directed by Paul Mazursky and starring John Cassavetes as a wife-murdering orchestra conductor, the foil to Peter Falk's famously rumpled detective. It also featured, in roles as Cassavetes' two spoiled teens, Molly Ringwald and myself. This TV movie was something Mazursky had tossed off around the time of the making of Tempest, the latter a theatrical release featuring Cassavetes and Ringwald, though not, alas, me. That pretty well summed up my luck as an actor, the ceiling I'd always bumped against, television, but never the big screen. Cassavetes was among Perkis Tooth's holy heroes, so he'd captured this broadcast, recorded it off some Twilight Hour rerun. The tape was intact with vintage commercials from the middle 80s, O.J. Simpson still sprinting through airports and so forth. I hadn't seen this Columbo episode since it was broadcast, and it gave me a feeling of seasick familiarity. Not that Mazursky, Falk, Cassavetes, and Ringwald had been like family to me. I'd barely known them, yet it still felt like watching a home movie. It led to the curious sense that in some fashion I'd already been dwelling here in Perkis's apartment for 20-odd years before I met him. His knowledge of culture and the weirdly synesthetic connections he traced inside it made it seem as though this moment of our viewing the tape together was fated. Indeed, as if, at 12 years old, I'd acted in this forgettable and forgotten television show alongside John Cassavetes as a form of private communion with my future friend, Perkis Tooth. Thanks. Thanks, everyone, for coming. Really great. Thanks.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.